Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Scott Rose. I represent the petitioner, Joshua Holman, in this original proceeding in habeas corpus. When Mr. Holman woke up this morning in the Missouri Eastern Correctional Center in Pacific, Missouri, he began serving his 824th day of detention for an offense that under Missouri law is a misdemeanor with a maximum punishment of 365 days in jail. Mr. Holman was sentenced to serve 14 years in the Department of Corrections for what I would submit was the petty crime of stealing used purses and used clothing from a storage facility. Mr. Holman asked this court to issue a writ of habeas corpus and order him to be discharged on the offense of stealing for two reasons. One, the state's recent decision in State v. Bazell applies to the offense of stealing over $500. And two, that the recent decision in State v. Bazell applies to cases that have completed direct review, such as Mr. Holman's. Regarding the first point, the applicability of Bazell to the offense of stealing over $500, this is an issue that has been heavily litigated throughout the state, and all three divisions of the Court of Appeals have already ruled that Bazell does apply to the offense of stealing over $500. Those cases are cited in my brief, and I'm sure that the court is familiar with McMillan, Turrentine, Bowen, Metternich, and Culp v. Lawrence. The reasoning of these decisions was based first and foremost on the text of the statute, and of course this court's leading decision on the statute itself, which was Bazell. I was certainly pleased to see that in the first argument this morning that there appeared to be widespread agreement that we should begin with the text of the statute in determining its applicability. And the felony enhancement provision, as this court discussed in Bazell, makes clear that it is to apply in any offense in which the value of property or services is an element. But the offense is defined elsewhere for all of the 18 subparagraphs that follow, the 18 different ways that it could be enhanced to a felony. Subsection 3 is not a definition of crimes. It is the definition of an enhancement.
Does the jury have to find one of those 18 in order to convict them of the enhanced felony, the enhanced crime?
If for an offense to which subsection 3 is applicable, the answer would be yes.
So why isn't it an element? You heard the questions in the prior
right.
case.
Right, because of the text of the statute. As this court explained in Bazell, the crime of stealing is defined in subsection 1, and the crime of stealing does not include the value of property or services as an element.
But doesn't your interpretation give no meaning at all to sub 3, notwithstanding any other provision of law, any offense in which the value of property or services as an element is a Class C felony, if has absolutely no meaning because nothing qualifies?
Oh, I mean, there could easily be other statutes to which subsection 3 would qualify.
Give me an example.
Well, there could be other places in the criminal code.
If none have been identified to us as yet, or if none are identified, then that provision would have no meaning. And yet, as you note, it has 18 subsections and fills half a page. Can we consider that in determining the legislature's intent and whether they intended those provisions to be elements of the crime?
Well, if the court's analysis got that far, I suppose the answer would be yes, but I would submit that the analysis shouldn't get that far because we should only get into questions of intent and how the statute fits in relation to other statutes if the meaning of the text is not clear.
And certainly you're exactly right, but my question, and perhaps not well phrased, is isn't that a relevant consideration in deciding whether it is clear and unambiguous that, in fact, interpreting as we do gives no meaning at all to half the statute? Therefore, doesn't that raise a question on its, by itself as to the meaning of the statute and what their intent was?
Well, I don't concede that it gives no meaning to the rest of the statute because the reader of the stealing statute shouldn't have to be familiar with the entire Missouri Code to know whether there are other code provisions to which subsection 3 would apply.
Do you agree that under our rules of I started to say construction, but I don't think you get to construction at that point, that you don't look at any phrase or any sentence in a document, a statute or another document, in isolation, that you look at that language in the context of whether it's the paragraph or the entire document to see, in fact, if it is plain and ordinary meaning or if it has any ambiguity, or if its plain and ordinary meaning is informed by other language in the statute.
As I understand the cases, as I read the cases, these canons of construction, such as reading it in paramateria with the other language in the statute and with other statutes and the rule of lenity and all of the canons of construction, only come into effect. They're only part of the discussion if there is a finding that the statute itself, the words on the page, are not clear and unambiguous.
But the words on the page are not in isolation. They are in reading them in context.
Well, right, but
it says notwithstanding any other provision of law, so it refers back to other provisions. Doesn't it refer back to one and say, notwithstanding what's in one, you have to look into whether $500 is it, whether there's value is an element of the crime.
When
you,
value,
you can't just look at one in isolation. You have to look at it in context of the whole statute.
Right. Subsection 3 says notwithstanding any other provision of law, which would mean notwithstanding subsection 1 and notwithstanding any other statute anywhere else.
Right.
So anything that could be found that could contradict what's about to be said, I mean, that's how I interpret notwithstanding any other
yes.
provision of law. But then it is in subsection 3. It is subsection 3 that says any offense in which the value of property or services is an element.
I mean, and then it lists subsections, some of which have value. And those are elements the jury has to find.
One has value, one of the 18. And so I think the interpretation that is being discussed would say that the offense stealing over 500 is unique among the 18 subparagraphs of subsection 3. Because, right, I mean, the other 17 subsections Basel would apply to.
Absolutely.
And it would only be the very first subparagraph.
Well, doesn't K say live fish raised for commercial sale with a value of $75? And P says any document of historical significance which has a fair market value of 500 or more.
All right.
So there are three potentially out of the 18.
But it would leave 15 with still no meaning, in effect. So.
Well, the meaning is informed by other statutes. I mean, that's what when subsection 3 says, and I'm talking about subsection 3 that says it, not subsection 1. When subsection 3 says that an element, any offense in which the value of property or services is an element, it's importing the elements from other places, mm-hmm. whether it's subsection 1 or other parts of the code. It is not, the elements do not follow after that. The elements are being imported from elsewhere. I think that's plain, and that's what this court found. This court's exact words in Bazell were, the value of the property or services appropriated is not an element of the offense of stealing. That's why it's different. And that language, although, of course, it was in the discussion of whether it was stealing of firearms, the language and the logic and reasoning behind the language apply to all 18 subparagraphs of subsection 3. To say it's different because that particular subparagraph concerns value and then the other two that the Chief Justice mentioned concern value, well, that's circular. That's saying that the elements of the crime are contained in the felony enhancement provision. But I think the text is clear in Subsection 3 that the elements are being imported from other statutes.
But those are elements, too. They're just not the elements being referred to, because under Ring and Apprendi and that line of cases, any sentencing enhancement factor that's necessary for the punishment is an element.
Well, each of the 18 is an additional element that has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury in order for it to be enhanced.
Right.
But the remaining elements, the other elements, are imported from other places in the code. Those other elements are not described in subdivision 3. And that language applies to all 18 parts of it. The value part of it relates to the felony enhancement element. It doesn't relate to the other elements of the underlying offense.
If we accepted your interpretation, would that have implications for other statutes also, such that raise the level of a sexual offense depending upon the age of the victim and other kinds of factors which are listed out as reasons to raise the level of the offense? In a similar fashion.
Well, number one, I would argue this court has already accepted my interpretation in Bazell. But number two, to answer your question more directly, I would say it depends on the wording of those particular statutes. This subsection 3, I think, is very clear. It's plain. There's no other way to interpret it that it's importing the elements from elsewhere in the code. If those others have the same language and are importing their elements from elsewhere in the code, then yes. But it all depends on what the statutory language is.
Counselor, I want to give you an opportunity to answer my question. Why doesn't Rule 2915 apply? This is clearly just a sentence in excess of the maximum allowed by law.
I think that's the answer, is that the Zena case and a long line of habeas cases hold that habeas is the appropriate vehicle to bring a sentencing defect. It's the fact that it's a sentencing defect that allows it to be brought in a habeas proceeding, when, of course, it could have been brought in a prior proceeding. There are cases that hold that, and I think the reasons for that go back to, well, two things. One, courts and lawyers used to call this jurisdictional. We said that it was jurisdictional.
Yeah, that's another point. That's before the or. But pardon? Some of them do talk about that, before the or. The court was without jurisdiction to impose a sentence. There are some that talk about that, but I can't find any that talk about what this phrase means, if it doesn't mean it's waived.
Right, but the court's discussion in Zena about that it's not really right to call this jurisdictional because it doesn't go to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court, that's appropriate, but why was it being called jurisdictional? And I think it was being called jurisdictional because it's a different kind of mistake than like an instructional error or the normal kinds of mistakes that a mistake of law or mistake of fact that a circuit court could make. It's a mistake that it's a decision that is beyond the power of the sentencing court to do. And that is a different kind of mistake than the normal mistake of law. And so they were calling it jurisdictional to denote that this is different, although I agree, jurisdictional, the word jurisdictional is a misnomer, as Zena explains. But there was a basis behind the use of that. And then ultimately, I think the reason for it goes back to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions on retroactivity that were the basis of Thornton v. Denny, which was Fiore v. White and Bunkley v. Florida. And this is why the Attorney General's discussion of State v. Stewart, in my view, is beside the point, because State v. Stewart was in 1992, and the critical Supreme Court decisions that determine Your Honor's question and the retrospective application came in 2001 and 2003. And those cases hold that where it is a statutory issue and the court is simply clarifying the meaning of the statute, that does not create new law. And so the court is not to engage in a retroactivity analysis. And the Supreme Court further found that it's a violation of the Due Process Clause to hold the petitioner convicted of conduct that as a matter of law is not a crime. That was the holding of Fiore, and then Bunkley extended that to an enhancement, which is what we have at issue here. So I think those are the answers to Your Honor's question about why it's not waived.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Turning to the last point that the petitioner was raising regarding the import of the Fiore decision, I want to emphasize that there was a long series of cases in the immediate aftermath of the Fiore decision that considered whether Fiore's standard, whether it's a mere clarification or is a change in the law, is satisfied when a state court is overruling a prior authoritative judicial interpretation on the same substantive issue as there had been previously been an authoritative judicial interpretation. And every single one of those cases holds that is a change in the law. It is not a mere clarification.
That means any case, though. You're saying any court of appeals case. So a prior substantive judicial interpretation. You're saying if anybody's ever interpreted the statute, you're stuck with that.
I would say that it, therefore that the retroactive application would therefore be limited to direct review.
It wouldn't be
only for substantive decisions. Obviously, there's a different set of rules that govern procedural decisions, for example, in the Whitfield context and so forth. But what this case, the court has said again and again is the presumed retroactive effect of new substantive decisions is that they apply solely to cases that are still pending on direct review at the time they're decided. And so the very limited exception to that is in the Fiore case when it's a mere clarification, not a change in the law. And every court that I'm aware of to address this question raised by Fiore has said.
I'm asking, when would it not be a mere clarification under your interpretation? If any court has ever interpreted it, then it couldn't be a mere interpretation, so it would have to be a first impression issue.
Absolutely right. I point to two cases. Fiore itself said, well, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court interpreted this statute for the very first time while after the Fiore's conviction was final. And then the Clem case that we cited from Nevada emphasized that. It says Fiore applies when the judicial construction is for the first time. It says that twice, for the first time. So yes, the state's position is that the holding of Fiore is, on at least for the limited context of substantive, new rules of substantive law, interpretations of criminal statute, if there's been a prior authoritative judicial interpretation, then that's not a mere clarification. That is a change in the law. That is, and that's that phrase, prior authoritative judicial interpretation, that on the same substantive issue is not my words. That's a direct quote from the Guzman case from the Iowa Supreme Court. So the Iowa Supreme Court, the Nevada Supreme Court, the Kansas Supreme Court, the Federal 10th Circuit, the Federal 11th Circuit, all of these cases that we cited in our brief all conclude the same thing, that Fiore does not apply when you're overruling a prior authoritative judicial interpretation. But again, I emphasize that the court need not address the retroactivity issue. It can, I think, readily resolve these cases on the interpretive question. And I would like to point out that when the petitioner argued, the petitioner's argument is that the statute, subsection 3, is very clear that it includes, I believe he said, elements, it only applies elements imported from other statutes, not the following language or imported from other places in the code. Those qualifications are not present in the plain text of the statute. I can't emphasize that enough. The phrase of subsection 3 is notwithstanding any provision of law, any offense. And it's unquestionable that there is a distinct offense here. It's a distinct offense that unquestionably has an element of value of property or services. And therefore, under the plain text of the statute, this court should conclude that stealing over $500 has been a Class C felony ever since 2002. And if there are no other questions, I'll step aside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to begin by pointing out that so the warden is arguing that there was a change in the law because that Basil constituted a change in the law based on prior decisions of other courts interpreting the same statute. And the prior decision that the warden is relying on is State v. Passley, which was a decision of the Southern District Court of Appeals in 2012. Well, my client, Mr. Holman, was convicted in 2008, 4 years before the decision that the warden relies on to show that there was supposedly a change in the law. So it's not clear to me, and it hasn't been addressed by the warden, as to why an overruled, no longer controlling decision of the Southern District 4 years after my client was convicted would have anything to do with what the law was at the time of his conviction. That is what the Fiore and Bunkley cases are about, and that is why it is not proper to engage in a retroactivity analysis in this situation. Mr. Holman, my client, is not seeking retroactive application of Basil, and I do not accept that characterization of the question before the court. The question, more properly, is whether it applies to cases that have completed direct review and are now on habeas. But that's not retroactive application. Mr. Holman is seeking application of the stealing statute as it was in effect at the time he pled guilty in 2008, now properly understood.
Yeah. So what procedural bar prong are you in then? Are you're not suggesting that the court didn't have jurisdiction at the time?
Well, there's
so tell me what prong you're in so I know how to think about it.
Sentencing defect. That's the prong which the jury...
Cause and prejudice?
No, sentencing defect is the prong, but the cases that use the word jurisdiction there are going back to the era when sentencing defects were called jurisdictional.
We used to call it jurisdictional competence, and there's dozens of cases that applied it to sentences in excess of those allowed by law. Did anything change when we said that wasn't jurisdictional in Webb? Did that change those cases or overrule those prior cases? No. Or did Zena say they continue to apply?
Well, as I interpret this court's ruling, is that it is simply changing the nomenclature of it. But whether it's called jurisdictional or sentencing defect, that's two ways of describing the same thing, both of which Mr. Holmes.
So I see the breadth of your argument. Anytime that there's a case that interprets a statute differently that would affect a sentence, the usual rules of finality just don't apply. So it's basically you have the right, habeas is an appeal for any time a sentence is affected by a later court's interpretation of a statute.
Only if the sentence that was actually imposed exceeds the maximum sentence authorized by law, as it does in the case of Mr. Holm.
Any other questions? Thank you. The case will be submitted.